So, I don't know how to put this. Who the fuck are you that you got this Brad Paisley interview?
This is the greatest thing, you know. So I grew up in New York. I grew
Okay.
up probably not so far from where you are.
We're in New
Sure.
York.
Well, I grew up in Westchester, New York. So I think that's a couple hours actually from you're in Rochester?
I'm in Syracuse, but I used to do
Syracuse.
college admissions work, and so I've been my so I did a 33-year stint in higher ed administration before I decided to retire in my late 50s and then started doing this a couple years later. And so where'd you go to high school?
Hastings High School, you just public.
I probably went there. I went to every high school in New York State. It was
Are you
like
serious?
there was a time when I could literally go into a town I hadn't been in before and go, let's see, where would they put the high school? Oh, over here. Yeah, I did it for 7 years. Fox Lane, Chappaqua. But you were saying who you are. So you grew up in New York State.
Yeah, so I grew up in New York State, grew up playing guitar. I actually had a guitar teacher in high school who really got me into country music and kind of telly playing, which was weird growing up in New York because nobody was into that.
Yep.
But went to school, I studied guitar performance at Berkeley and then moved to Nashville right after. And I worked in artist management because I was like,
Okay.
how the fuck am I gonna make a living playing guitar? So I work in artist management around the music industry. And then
Right.
I sort of started a media company in the pandemic, which is, covers the country music industry, which is kind of the main thing that I do and run. It's become like a country music trade publication. It's the
Okay.
largest one in the space. And then through that, I sort of started to play a lot more guitar. And then I've been out on the road with a lot of different acts. And then the Brad Paisley thing was crazy because I started a podcast too, and I started interviewing executives, and that became artists and guitar players and people that I was interested in as well.
Okay.
But the Brad thing was funny because I'd been chasing Brad Paisley to come onto my show
Course.
for years because he's like my icon. He's my hero on the telly.
Right.
Because
Exactly right.
you got into him too from the from his instrumental album. You started listening to him, right? And you
Yeah.
became a
Well,
fan.
it was, I've said it, and you probably saw, if you watch the back catalog,
Yeah.
Brad Paisley's Play record was the thing that snapped me out of my jazz coma.
Right.
That record. Yeah. I mean, I've been listening to Robin Ford and stuff. It wasn't a straight Miles Davis kind of world that I lived in, but that Paisley record, I just couldn't get over the tones on the record. And I was like, how is that a Telecaster pickup into amp? I just, and so of course I went down, researched it because that's who I am. Even
Right.
then. Yeah.
That was the thing that got me though, because I feel like I'd worn out the Jimmy Page sound and the Jimi Hendrix sound and all of that stuff, which is obviously the stuff we're all chasing. But the Brad stuff was like this thing that had that fatness to it, but it was a
Yeah.
totally different take
Yeah.
on what you could do with a super high gain lead sound. I think that's kind of what drew me to it. It was so funky and rich in overtones, and
Yeah,
it's.
and at the same time, it's easy to discount country. I wish I got to tell David I'm live. It's easy to discount country, but the fact is he played in a high school jazz band, and you can hear it.
Right, right.
He invites Robin Ford to be on that record. I'm like, who is this guy? And then I went back and listened to the other stuff. And I actually always, I grew up playing acoustic guitar, of course, like everybody. And actually, that's the only live playing I do now is I have a monthly acoustic jam that I go to. And so I'm kind of closer again to country and bluegrass like I was. That's actually, I came to jazz the weird in a weird way through bluegrass and David Grisman and Jerry Garcia and that stuff. I was never a big Deadhead, but I came through that side, through that corner.
Right.
So a guy who, describes country soloing as jazz on the back pickup, as Brad Paisley has said before. I'm like, that's great, so.
That's it. That's it. But to
Yeah.
wrap it up, so the Brad interview, and then this is really about you, Keith. This isn't about me. But to wrap it up, the Brad interview, I've been chasing him for years, trying to bother his team, bother his publicist, everyone as politely as I can. And finally, like within a week, of doing the interview, his team came to me and they said, we were just in a meeting with Brad who found this blue Paisley. And he was saying that he wanted someone to interview him on the blue Paisley who knew guitars
Yeah.
and who could also do an interview. And somebody on his team said, what about that kid, Zach? And Brad said, I don't know who that is. And they were like, I think he could do it. And the irony is, I was chasing them, chasing them, chasing them. And then they came to me. And
Yeah.
within 5 days, they were like, could you interview Brad on Friday? And it was Monday. And I was like, done, let's do it. And
Of
we
course,
did it, locked it in.
let me clear my schedule. Exactly.
Yeah.
I assumed incorrectly Because I guess I got an impression that you went to music school. I incorrectly assumed you did like a master's in music business or something at Belmont. I thought it was like the alumni office got you into Brad's interview. No, it was stick-to-itiveness on your part, which
It
I
was
like. I like that story better.
I like that story too. Yeah. No,
Yeah, I like
I
that
wish
story
somebody
better.
opened the door for me. Well, in a way they did, but I had to pound the first person I emailed when I moved to town in 2018, because I've been here for almost 5 years or 6 years now, I guess. First person I interviewed was his emailed was his manager, Bill Simmons, just to meet him. And I was like, I just moved to town. Can I meet you? Because I'm trying to meet people. And he met me in his office,
Oh, it's very cool of
which
him.
was so nice of him. It was incredible. And in my head, I'm like, oh, I'm 2 steps away from Brad Paisley. I'm going to interview him. And it took 5 years.
It'll be
Like,
next year. It'll be next week. We'll get that
it'll be
done.
next week again. And it took 5 years. So
Yeah, that's
anyway,
a
I don't know
riot.
what the moral of the story is, but if there's anything, that's it. But I so appreciate you doing this. I'm such a fan of the channel
Well,
and the
that's a riot.
history of the videos and everything. I was going to ask you just to start, because I was watching this video that Rick Beato did where he found this 52 bass that belonged to his uncle, and it was Joe Bonamassa bought it, and then you
From the House
helped
of
him
Guitars.
from the House of Guitars, and you helped him reconnect with the bass because you saw the video with Joe Bonamassa. Is that how that story went? How did you, what was the story here where you were talking to Rick about and you found the bass?
So the story is Rick and I have been friends since we both worked at Ithaca College in the late 80s. And I actually, without going too far into it, I actually made a video called I Took Lessons with Rick Beato, because Rick Beato was my jazz guitar teacher. And he's 2 years younger than me, but he was right out of New England Conservatory, had just finished doing he did his entire master's program in one calendar year with Mick Goodrick and all the people at New England, 85 or something. He had just come back on the faculty, and the head of the jazz department was like, yeah, I don't want this guy from the admissions taking a guitar lesson from me. I'm gonna give you to this junior faculty member. Let me assign to this guy. This Beato is his name. Here's his phone number, call him. So Rick and I became fast friends then. And so it's a thing where and then when he started we talk. Rick is one of those people who's amazing at staying in touch. He's just incredible about it, better than anyone I've ever known. And it's not a networking thing. He's from a big family. He would tell you that one of the things he and I have in common is that I grew up in a family of five. He grew up in a family of seven. He grew up in Fairport. I grew up in Lyons. When we started comparing notes, because he went to school, at Ithaca, but he also was back in Rochester all the time. We were all at these same shows. We'd been at the Weather Report show, in 81 at the Eastman Theater. We were both at the Pat Metheny show in Geneva. It was like this weird thing when we finally met. So we've been friends, and we literally talk probably 5 or 6 times a week. Like it's a regular ritual. We both finish breakfast. He'll be sitting in his garden, and we're talking about things. And he's a great storyteller, obviously. That's the thing that he and I have in common. And we both have pretty serious memories. As Somerset Maugham always said, I have a good memory for things that concern me, which I always thought described memories for everybody. It's like, oh, if it clicks for you, it's going to stick for you. So, I didn't mean to make that rhyme. So anyway, Rick had told me this story years ago, and then he was getting this award in the Music Hall of Fame for Rochester Music Hall of Fame. So we drove, my fiance and I drove to Rochester. We had lunch with him, and he said, "Hey, after this, I'm going to go to House of Guitars, with Layla, his daughter." And I'm like, "Oh, that'd be really cool. I was just there, recently with somebody who follows the channel." And he goes, "Yeah, that bass." And he reminded, I said, "Yeah, you mean your uncle's bass? You think that's your uncle's bass?" Because literally, he showed it in the video. His uncle's family lived around literally like 2 blocks
Right.
from the House of Guitars. So we don't really know how it ended up from the house to the House of Guitars. But I mean, the first time I borrowed the car and told my parents I was going into town to get a sub sandwich, I got in the car and I drove to Rochester. Completely had no business driving to Rochester, and I drove to the House of Guitars. So that was the
Of
first
course.
thing I ever did. Yeah, of course, exactly. Right. So, and then like there's famous people like, well, famous Andy Babiuk, who wrote the Beatles gearbooks and the Rolling Stones gearbooks, was a guitar salesman in the late 70s and early 80s at the House of Guitars. So, it was the same. Rick and I were both trying to convince him, not unknowingly, to let us play the late 70s Norlin junk Les Paul. But anyway, that's another story.
Right. Wait, so what was Rick teaching you when you would take those early lessons with him? Was he teaching you just jazz theory, and was he a monster player? I mean, I'm sure he was, but was
Yeah,
that
no,
your experience
absolutely. And
exactly?
he had just finished playing his master's. He has a master's degree in, I'm not sure if it's in composition or if it's in jazz performance. But the reality was, when he was in Boston, he was gigging all over town. Fast forward to like 2 years ago, I did a video on the history of Gibson jumbo guitars. And there was this beautiful piece of playing on a 57 Southern jumbo that Duke Levine did. And I'm like, oh, well, I've exchanged emails with him before. I don't know him, but I email him and I'm like, at the last minute, I'm like, I should name drop to get them to give me. And I'm like, I'm a good friend of Rick's and he's mentioned you before. And he writes back in his, and as an upstate New Yorker, he says, any friend of Rick's a friend of mine. I immediately hear sarcasm, not sarcasm. I reach out to Rick. He's like, oh yeah, Duke and I did hundreds of gigs, jazz guitar duets. I'm like, okay, A, that there are gigs for jazz guitar duets in the Boston area, it just freaks me out. But the B, that you guys were so close. He's like, yeah. Duke's just a few years older than me, went back to school, blah, blah. So I knew him through that and I knew him through other things. And yeah, it's so many connections. It's such a music, I'm sure you're running into this with what you do, such a small world in a lot of
Yeah.
ways. Yeah,
And
such a
Duke,
small world.
who, when I went to school in Boston, I would see Duke play at an Atwood's Tavern and I would chase him down for lessons. And he'd say, no, I'm not really a guitar teacher. I don't really think I have anything that I could show you. And I would pound him. And then finally, I would just start showing up at his house. And maybe 4 or 5 times he would sit down with me and really show me stuff. But the best stuff
Wow.
that he would say to me was like, he was like, I can't really teach you anything, but he was like, go listen to Luxury Liner and go learn
Right.
every Albert Lee solo on that. That's what I did. Like, that's the kind of stuff he would say to me. And that
Yeah.
was super helpful. But I think he's one of the best telly players that I think still doesn't really get the credit
Oh, totally.
he
And
deserves.
one of the best, most melodic players out there,
Yeah.
period. Just an incredible sense. The videos that he's done for the Music Emporium, where he just sits down, it's kind of like Ariel posing. I just interviewed Ariel on the channel. I had
Yeah,
to
I saw that.
check issues and stuff. But I said, how do what do you do? And they sit down. And Duke is the same. He just sits down and he's got this, 59 junior in his lap. He's like, what would this tell me to do? And they just start playing.
Right.
And beautiful stuff comes out. Completely original, beautiful things. Anyway, yeah.
Wait, so you see the Rick's uncle's bass in the Bonamassa video, and then it
Sorry.
clicks for you
So,
that you're like, that's you just knew
yep.
that that was the bass he was talking
Well,
about.
7 years ago, Bonamassa made this video with reverb, and I watched it. And because of the nature of the channel, with the most music, least gear, the whole sort of how much is enough, channel thing, I'm like, well, Joe, again, another upstater, is a poster child for having no sense of what's enough. I mean, just like, I'm like, okay, so 7 years later, has he come around to wrestling with that? And the answer is he has. He's actually kind of changed the way he's collecting now. And even in that interview, they got him to talk about what he's going to do with it. Like if he dropped dead, what would happen to the collection? Which is, it was a beautiful answer. And so I'm watching this thing and it's a half an hour long or something. And I'm watching the whole thing. And like 23 minutes into it, he goes, yeah, I was a kid and I used to go to the House of Guitars. And he's like, I don't know how much younger than us he is, probably 10, 12 years at least. And he holds the bass up. And I'm like, that's the 52 jazz that used to be above, I mean, precision that used to be above the door. And I didn't, and you know what? When I was going under it, all I knew was it was old. I didn't know about blackguards. I didn't know, that 52 was the first year of the P bass. I didn't know any of that stuff. They were just old and they were so expensive that they were in a case that you could never get them down.
Right.
That's all I knew.
Right.
And so when he held it up and he said that, I immediately texted Rick and I'm like, yeah, that's the bass. If that's the one. That has to be it. And Rick's family had been telling that story for years too. And the only, I don't want to throw any shade on the House of Guitars, but the only thing about them was they would never get those down and show them to anybody. You're kind of like, you don't want to show me the serial number on that. Okay.
That's every guitar store, though. Every
That's
guitar
true.
store you go to growing up. Is like that. And then at some point, I think you had said you revisit a store with someone and then they were, or you came to Carter and Carter was just giving you acoustics. You weren't even asking for them,
That's
right? Like
exactly
that,
right. Yeah. Well, and
it flips like that.
the funny thing was I walked in there and I don't come to Nashville. It was like 2 years ago in the summer. And I came out there to do a video with Zach Childs. And then I went on and did videos with Rick. And it was summer vacation for me. That's what I did 2 years ago for summer vacation. And I walked in, the only person I feel like if there's any place in the world I might get recognized, it's Carter Vintage.
Yeah.
I go in, I do a loop around. As I'm coming back up the aisle, and Walter still owned it then, he looks at me and he goes, Keith, what are you doing here? That's what Walter, he's on a phone call because it's Walter, right? He's on a call, he's making a deal. What are you doing here? I'm like, oh, I was kind of hoping I could see John Roncalato. He's like, yeah, let me get John down here for you. And then after, and they're like, do you want to play the burst? No. Do you want to play this, 56 Strat? No, I don't, no. And then he was on the phone, and John and I were standing by the front door, and the staff had come by and go, oh, I love your stuff. And he just starts, he's on the phone. I can't say no. He's handing me Premore Martins to play just right over the camera. Yeah. And then afterwards, I said to John, I was like, those were amazing, but not like, I can't sleep at night amazing. He goes, yeah, those guitars don't get hung up.
Right.
Those guitars just come in and go right out the back door. So,
right.
Yeah.
It's funny. Brad said to me afterwards, when we finished the interview, we were talking about something. He said, my two biggest fears when I go out to dinner is that somebody's going to recognize me, is my first fear. And my second fear is that nobody's going to recognize me.
I've only had a couple of people recognize me on the street, they were both very weird times.
Yeah.
Actually, Zach Childs has way more stories of being recognized because he lives in a music town.
Right. Right. Of course.
Yeah.
Anyway. So when you were starting your channel originally, was it Rick who said to you, basically, put out 25 videos and then come on to my show? And was that the boost that gave it? Was that the thing that gave it the initial boost, is when you won his channel? And like, what were you learning in those 25 videos to get to that position, basically?
Well, actually, I just recorded the A-roll for a course that I'm going to do that's specifically written for how to do YouTube, but just for musicians, and all the different versions of what a channel would look like. Cause I think there's this misunderstanding that a channel has this one purpose of, you know, selling t-shirts or whatever, you know, channel purposes are. And so Rick was always, I was talking to him about his channel. It was growing pretty rapidly at the beginning. And if you look at the really, really early videos, he's doing phone videos just like anybody else. You know, his early videos look terrible and they sound terrible. And he said, you know, you always have such good stories, and, you know, you put things together in an interesting way. You should make some videos about, just as you're thinking, you know, Rick is very extemporaneous. He's just like talks to camera. I'm not that guy. I'm going to write a script. If you watch my early videos, I'm looking at you below the camera now, but on the early videos, I'm doing the same thing. I don't have a teleprompter for my script. I'm reading a piece of paper below and covering the J cuts with, you know, an image or something.
Yeah.
And so I started making videos, and I don't think I made 25. He did say make 25, and I think I had like 13. But the third video I ever made was a video called How Many Guitars Do You Need? And when I made that, Rick's like, oh my God, that's a perfect YouTube title. And no one had done it. Nobody had done a video where they did a series. There were a couple of people who did videos that with a similar title where they were really going, well, you need this. Oh no, you need these 15. You know, that was the joke. And I was like, no, really, it's a real thing. But I did that video as an exercise to teach myself editing, because I knew I would just do hundreds of pictures. And typically my videos, those history videos, have between 300 and 400 images in them now. So it was good. And it was that video, the fact that that video was there. And then I did this on a video with Dave Honorato and Rick, where Rick's describing it. I think it must have been the next summer. I went to Rick's every 6 months for the first year and a half of the channel, and made videos with him. And the first time when I got there, I had 427 subscribers, you know, basically your friends and your family and your family's friends, you know?
Yeah, right, right.
And then when I left, it's still the biggest, when I did a live stream of him where he actually made me play like chord changes for Bubasa so he could do a talk about it or something. And yeah, and when I left, and then I made, right on the heels of that, I started making short history videos about amplifiers. And the history videos are what took off. But the weekend after Rick's, I had 2,500 subs in a day or something, you know, just from that live stream. So
there was most of the growth from YouTube, because I'm trying to crack the code myself.
Sure.
Has it really been from just putting out the content and then the YouTube algorithm picking it up and feeding it to the audience? Or has it been from moments like going on a bigger channel or just a different channel and exposing your audience to that, or a combination of both?
I think you need to get your head above the horizon to start to get enough views, like that moment with Rick. But if I didn't have something in the catalog, and honestly, Rick was absolutely right. You need to have a deep enough catalog so that when you come above the horizon, people can go there and watch three videos. And then they get a sense of whether or not they're going to subscribe or not. On average, still, my videos, you know, the short histories run a half an hour. But still, when you look at my analytics, the average number of views is 1.8. Which means people on average go and watch two of my videos at a time, which is a huge investment of time. I mean, in this day and age, especially, it's always been true, but especially now, your attention is the most precious thing you can give.
Right.
And so to get somebody's attention, to get somebody to do that, the short histories took off, but it's interesting. I have this sort of duality in the channel where I make videos about like what's enough and minimalism and how many guitars do you need. Those videos drive subscriptions, but they also drive merchandise sales. And to me, you know, buying a t-shirt like this is a real indication of somebody wanting to be a part of the community. And when I make videos like I just did about I'm working on a video now. What's the most important moment in electric guitar history? And a video like that will generate so much engagement that it gets the algorithm's attention, and people watch the whole thing because they want it. They're waiting to know. It's a list video, which is always a sure thing to have long view times. But it's that the only things you need to know about the algorithm are you making thumbnails that are engaging enough? I always tell people this: a good thumbnail and a title is the beginning of a conversation. Nobody's going to want to hear the rest of the story if the first line of the story isn't a great story, doesn't get your attention. You know, hey, is that a Brad Paisley Telecaster? That's a very cool guitar, you know?
Yeah.
And that would start a conversation with somebody, you know, at a pickup gig someplace.
And I think you said this when you interviewed Tim Pierce, would you send him thumbnails? Like you would send him three thumbnails and he would pick the best one. And were you designing them yourself basically?
Oh, always. Yeah. No one can start the conversation but you. So I don't have, it's always funny when people say, I want to thank you and your team. And I go, I'm in a small bedroom in a ranch house in upstate New York.
This is the team.
That's right. So yes, I have lots of people that I work on videos with, but when it comes to reading comments and answering comments and I read them all still, I'm right at that. I don't know. I'm right at a size where I can still get through that at 267, whatever it is this morning, 1,000. So the answer to your question about subs and how do you break through is I'd say it's consistency. You need to be putting things out on a schedule, almost treat it like a television show. And then people get, so there, I literally, when I don't have a Thursday morning release, I get messages on Instagram from people like, am I going to get something tomorrow? Is it
going
to
be What do
I do Saturday?
With my life now? I can't watch your video. There's a chunk.
Well, you know what? I know the guys at that pedal show now after all these years, but if that's my Friday morning, like I set time aside and watch that pedal show on Fridays, you know? So right. I totally get that. As the old joke goes, I'm also a fan, you know? I think that's the key. That's one of the keys. Like I put it all in the course, but the real thing is, quality over quantity. There was this time when people thought you had to do two a week. There's so many successful channels where that's not true. I got to know Tim because Tim was burned out, fried, and he was talking to Rick about it. They're really good friends. And Rick says, and Tim's like, I got to take time off. It was like the holidays. He's like, I got to take some time off. And Rick's like, you know what? You're talking to the wrong guy. You should talk to Keith. Keith knows about taking time off. Keith knows about work-life balance. And so Tim called, literally, he's like, can I call you? I'm like, of course. And so we had this hour-long conversation. Tim and I have these long conversations. And yeah, there is this sort of brain trust that you have to build where you can trust other people's, you know, I tease Tim that he's the title whisperer. No one titles like Tim. He's has a real knack. It took him a while. I watched him learn it. But once he did, he starts a conversation like nobody else. And of course, no one has his life. He's like Rick that way. He's a unicorn and that he's in a space where his whole life led up to that. I saw Derek Wells do an interview lately and I've just been quoting it all over the place where he said, when people hire him for a session, they're not paying him for the time he's there. They're paying him for the 30 years he spent getting ready to sit in the chair. The time in the chair is free.
Right.
And I was like, oh my God, that's it. That's where Rick is. That's Zach Childs, where he can just turn on his phone and do 20 minutes on string gauges. Who can do that? You know, like nobody, there's nobody like Zach Childs. So,
right. Exactly.
Yeah, not me.
You had this conversation with George Groon. I heard you say in an interview that I thought was such an interesting thing that he said, which was you were talking about bursts.
Yeah.
And I think this was in preparation for your Les Paul video. And he said
actually,
that
I did a specific video about bursts and it was in
yes.
And I had talked to him a couple of times before that, but he was really sweet to give me the time. Yep.
And he said to you that basically compared to an early Marden or compared to a Stradivarius violin, that the craftsmanship on a burst is just, there's nothing there. It's basically nothing. Is that what he said? What did he tell you? What's his take on bursts?
His specific thing was that all the people that are my age are going to die, and then bursts won't be worth what they are now because they are just electric guitars. Let's not kid ourselves. They're not like, he said, it's not as if they're a pre-war D-45. That's what he said, because there were 93 of those built. 93. That's it. You know, you can name off the top of your head probably a dozen people who own those.
Yeah.
And that's, and you don't even know if all 93 survive. So as in George's opinion, because he is an acoustic guitar guy, he's like, no, those things, and they do still all work. That's the amazing thing, you know, like a Strad, like a Stradivarius violin, that they all still work is incredible. I think that, and you hear people say that not all 59s are amazing and all this kind of stuff. But actually I just had somebody from a channel, from somebody that follows the channel, a guy from California, and I got a DM and he says, hey, what's your shipping address? I'm like, no, what are you doing? And he's like, just give me your shipping address. And so I get the box. Oh, he sends me the UPS label. 18
I saw
pounds.
This on your Instagram. This is the
most, just today, right?
This is the most, okay, I'll finish the story. This is the most ridiculous thing ever that this showed up at your door.
So the box comes, it's not well packed at all. It's not like wrapped in bubble and double boxed or anything. It's in like an inexpensive triangular box. This is a guy who's got a very busy life. And his handle is Gig with Vintage. He's an amazing guy, He gigs like a 52 Les Paul and an old Vibra Verb that he, anyway. So the UPS guy goes, this got ripped open and it's like, but it's got a hard case. It's an original 59 Junior that's got more mileage on it than anything I've ever seen in the original case. And the case has got all this mileage on it. It's just, and then you know what? You plug it in and it's got like the headstock brake was fixed with fiberglass. I'll put those pictures up tomorrow. It's just, and the thing is all the magic that you've ever heard. You dial the volume and the tone back halfway and the old Central Lab pots and that Bumblebee, whatever magic is in there, and that old growth Honduran mahogany. Oh my God. I was playing James Taylor. Like you could treat the thing like an acoustic guitar. You could go to a duo gig where someone's playing acoustic and you're playing that old Junior with the one P90 and you'd be happy. And I emailed pictures to Ariel and Justin Ostrander and Adam Levy. And I just got stuff. Oh, and Jed Hughes. They were like, oh man, that is a thing of beauty. And they all said the same thing. You can do anything on those.
So, yeah. Wait, so going back to what Grun said though, was his point that it just about the quantity? Cause does he feel the same way about like flying V's, Carinas, or is it just the craftsmanship of those instruments is so much more respectable?
I don't think he wasn't saying that they weren't well made, because certainly those guitars are all handmade guitars. I mean, the late 50s Kalamazoo factory was just that. If you look at the pictures, everybody's just a luthier, you know, there. But I don't think he was saying that. I think he was saying that it's just not at the same level at all. A solid body electric guitar is just not a D45 Martin. Yeah, exactly.
Which is,
I mean, you got to remember all Rosewood Martin guitars were Brazilian Rosewood until like 72, 74, when Brazil changed their rules and they wouldn't let anybody export logs anymore. And Martin had no interest in having someone else cut the wood. They were buying whole logs from Brazil and then cutting the wood locally.
Right.
So, yeah. For you, so that's what George was saying.
For you, you always say, like, you'll hold a Strandberg and you go, this is my Blackguard Tele. And to me, I love to hear you say that, because to me, I'm like, to me, a Tele is a Tele. I've got a Tele over here. Like, to me, I own a Tele right there. Yeah. I actually have that same guitar. I bought one of those recently. That's the new Japanese.
Yeah, that's the JV Mod custom, right? I mean, that one has Ron Ellis pickups in it.
No, mine does not, but I saw you do that kind of Nashville mod and it inspired me. I'm like, ooh, could I do that? I actually leave it in New York in storage because I gig a lot in New York and I wanted a guitar I could just leave one in New York without flying back and forth with
guitar. And that's a perfect one because you can adjust the truss rod.
Exactly.
Right at the headstock. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Adam Levy's got dibs on that.
Okay.
He's like, that would be a good touring telly. You just let me know if you need to let that go.
Okay. Exactly. So you'll hold the Strandberg and you'll say, oh, this is my Blackguard Tele, but you've got a Tele there. But to me, like, I've never been able to wrap my head around the Strandberg guitar being like a Tele thing. Like, to me, I think about shredders playing them or whatever. I play a Tele because I want to look like I'm playing a Tele. But what is it about those guitars that you loved? I've actually never played one, but I know so many people who do. Like, do you love the frets on them, the way they're perfectly in tune? Like, what is it about those that you really love?
It's actually, I'll try to do a really short version of it, Zach. So in 2016, I had some medical stuff and I was in the hospital for 70 days. I went from like weighing 165 pounds to weighing 123 pounds. I literally, when I got out of the hospital, was so weak. And the guitar, when I went into the hospital, the guitar I played, I had actually taken my collection of like three dozen electric guitars and had a big, moment and had whittled it down to three PRS DGTs, three different DGTs. Actually, four, because that's another story. Anyway, when I got out of the hospital, those 8-pound guitars were too heavy for me to play. And I got so fatigued so fast, even my left hand got tired so fast, even was playing nines on electric or tens. I guess I did have those strings with 11s, but still, I just got tired so fast. It was exactly the time when the Strandberg came out with the Salen model, which is that Tele-ish single cutaway. And the Salen, I don't know if you know this, Salen is actually a town in Sweden where they hold the Swedish country picking championships. And I'm like, wait, there is a Swedish country picking championships? He's like, yep, I've always been really inspired by it. I wanted to do it a single cut. I love that they do that. I have one that's set up as an Esquire, with, a black guard that's matte finished like the original ones were. And it's an ash body with a maple neck, beautiful bird's eye maple neck. It's a previous generation. He's really, in my opinion, improved the neck substantially in this current version. It's one of those things like I don't own any core PRSs anymore. I don't love the shape. But when I'm playing them, I'm not looking at it and they disappear. The Strandbergs for me are just like that. And I can't tell you how many people now have bought Strandbergs because of my affiliation with Strandbergs. They're like, wait, you're an old guy playing this weird guitar. Why? Oh, because it's easier on your hands, because you can play. I got arthritis. I'm 77 years old. I put all my guitars away 3 years ago. Oh my God, I can play again. I mean, and that really, Ola's motto was, play more comfortably, play longer, or something like that. That was his earliest, branding images. And that's absolutely true. And it's funny, the only guitar I have here currently that really competes with that junior is there's a metal guy named Paul Masvidal who used to have a signature Strandberg single pickup guitar. He had an EMG in it with a active preamp and all this stuff. I asked those guys to send me one because I had this idea of bar rig for the future. And I was like, okay, so you're going to be playing a Stomp XL and a Strandberg with a single pickup like you would for a straight rock blues gig. Single pickup's all you need, whatever. I reached out to Bare Knuckles. I got a pickup that you could easily switch from series to parallel. You can really get a great P90 sound with it. The guitar weighs like 5 pounds. If, it's hollow, with a maple top and then a burl on top of it. It looks totally metally and it sounds like a junior because it's just incredibly resonant. I think if you were, I mean, I'm 5'10", 150 pounds. If you're a bigger person, a Strandberg is going to look like a toy. But on me, I ran a clip in a video recently where I was playing, I have a Salen that's semi-hollow with where Lindy Fralin made me a set of pickups for it to be my burst. I was like, I need this to be a Les Paul. I mean, if a great burst is a Tele on steroids, couldn't we start with a Tele platform, Lindy, and take it the other way? He was like, oh, I love this project. So he wound me a Blues Special, which is the pickup that Brad used, right? And then he wound me a mini humbucker to match it. So
How
that's what.
close, though, do you think is your Esquire Strandberg Tele type guitar to say the one behind you? Like, don't you think the ashtray bridge plays an
It's
effect and all that stuff?
all the bridge. Yeah,
It's
it
all.
is all the bridge. It'll get as close as any, you can get Tele style pickups for your Strat. That guitar's not a vibrato bridge, so it gets closer in my opinion because it's all bolted down. And he keeps evolving the bridge. So I don't have the current one. But honestly, I'm not a picker. I'm not a chicken picking guy. So in my hands, it does what it needs to do. I have this because I did a video on the Made in Japan Fenders, and like I just ordered a Squier Classic Vibe. I like to, even though I don't play on my videos, I like to play the guitars I'm doing the history of for months before I do the history. If I don't have a sense of hands-on, and that was a guitar that came out at that time, it's a perfect example of what they do in Japan. At a glance, it looks just like an or like a 59 custom. They're incredibly rare, but then you realize that the neck is a soft V, like a 57. Like what? 56. It's like they stir all these things together, and it's a really cool guitar. I mean, that one weighs like 7 pounds. It's great.
Mine's
even with
killer
three
too.
pickups.
I picked it up. I was looking for something, and I picked it up in New York at I was in a guitar store in New York. I picked it up, and I was like, "This thing's awesome and super affordable too."
Yeah,
Not that we're
exactly.
plugging it necessarily, but
No. Right.
it's a
We
great
both
buy.
know the guys at Fender who owe us lunch now. But
Yeah.
right, it's not like they did that, and they didn't send me that guitar. I bought it. I bought it from a guy in Reverb, actually. Yeah.
The juniors though to me are like I've been dying to get my hands on a junior because I feel like it's one of the things I talk about is how much you want to get into the vintage guitar game, although you're kind of on the fence about, but I think that by the time I'd be able to afford any of these vintage instruments, the price is just going to keep going up unless
It
the
is.
price comes down because all the boomers die, based on that
Yeah.
argument.
I don't actually, and I just did a video where I called The Only Guitars That Matter.
Yeah.
And I came up with that title, though Tim did bless it before I put it out. He's like, "Oh, that's an excellent title." And basically it was a conversation I had with Rick where the Les Paul, the Strat, and the Tele are the only three guitars that are really immediately recognizable. And I think the Tele is just a thing. That's all there is to it. So anyway.
I can't believe what it's like to be you though. People just send you 59 Les Pauls
Well, actually, not Les Paul, the
or
Les Paul
juniors.
Junior. Yeah.
They send you
Actually,
59 juniors in the mail like it's nothing. I mean,
the first
what a life,
one,
Keith.
yeah, I know it is a hard thing. Somebody's got to do it. The first thing that happened like that was 2 years ago. I made a video about Blackguard Tellies, the history of Blackguards. I mean, it's really this little tiny slice of history. And I got an email from a guy. No, in the comments, a guy wrote, "If you're going to do a video," I said I was going to do it. I was working on the script. "If you're going to do that, you should play a Nachocaster." Ha ha ha! Yeah, I'd love to play a $7,000 Tele style guitar. He's like, I'm like, email me. Ha ha ha! All in the comments on a video. He emails me. He goes, "I'll send you mine." So a guy mailed me his Nacho,
Oh my
and I had it
God.
for 6 months. And he's a movie producer in California. And he basically said that he plays in a band with other movie producers. And he goes, "It was so cool, to have you use that. And I will tell you that I don't know if you played a Nacho, but it wasn't set up the way I would set it up. There was nothing about the guitar that I would expect that way. And it was one of the nicest playing, most resonant guitars I've ever played. I don't know if they're all like that. It was incredible. And it was an incredible experience." Anyway, that guy was like, "Yeah, between us, we pretty much have everything. Just let me know." He overnighted me the guitar and he overnighted it back.
Oh
So it
my
cost him
God.
about $1,000 to lend me the guitar for a
Yeah.
video. Yeah.
It's weird because I've played a couple Nachocasters and they sort of play the way that you want a lot of vintage Tellies to play. But then if you play a lot of vintage Tellies, they don't always play like you think they're going to play.
Right.
So the Nachocasters almost feel like you think a vintage Telly is going to play.
I have a Danocaster Finline here right now. Very similar experience. Just
Yep.
blew me away. Yeah, incredible. I think it's a testament to that sounds so hokey. I guess I don't care. It's a testament to how much community people feel like they're a part of it. And I did a video actually called I think it was a live stream, "Can You Trust 5 Watt World?" where I basically say, "You know what? At this point in my life, nobody's throwing money at me that would influence my opinion." Like, I'm not even tempted because no one's trying to tempt me. And furthermore, everybody has to decide who to trust, period. And if you trust me, great, because you can. I'm going to give you my real opinion. And people extend that to, "I'm just going to send you this guitar." I mean, the guy sent it to me with a thank you note. Like, basically, he's thanking, "This is my thank you to you for doing what you do." So, yeah. And he's great, actually. Obviously, he has my phone number. He texted me and said, "You missed an opportunity in that Ariel Posen interview because you touched on your definition of success." He's like, "You should do a whole video with professional musicians of all levels of what their definition of success is." Because I think that that's back to the heart of like doing YouTube. I've actually spent time in the course saying, "You need to decide where you want to get to with this, or you're never going to get there." I saw Oprah or somebody saying recently, they say, "Why do you think people don't succeed more? They don't know what they want. They
Do you have
don't
a
sit
sense?
down
Yeah.
and think about what they want." Yep.
Do you have a sense with your channel? Like, are you still trying to get it to a certain place, or do you really like where it is right now and the goal is just to keep putting out content and sustaining it? Or is there a
Yeah,
place that
my.
you're trying to bring it to?
My idea, I mean, I would egometric wise, I'd love to break 300 or 500 or some number. The reality is, I get about 100 new subs a day. That's it. Not even. It probably averages more like 70. a day across a month, you put out a video, you get a spike, you know, you have that falls back off until you put the next video out. I've always been fine with that slow growth. I've had some videos, like I just did a video called Great Guitars That Suck to Own, and it did 350 views in a month. My goal is to have only make evergreen videos, which is to say, I don't make anything that's this week's news. If the video isn't just as good 6 months from now as it is today, I'm not interested in making it. I only want to make content that builds a catalog. And to be honest, Zach, what that does then is it builds a foundation. I went to, I did a couple of videos before I went away, but I actually was able to spend a month in Spain this year. And I've always been fascinated by foreign languages, and I've never been able to do that because I always had a more straight day job, but I could do the channel from there. I mean, I can't do this, you know, but I could write, I wrote the course while I was there, all that kind of thing. So yeah, those are the kinds of goals I have for the channel at this point. I've never wanted the channel to get so big that I couldn't keep up with the comments. I actually don't get a ton of email. And I'm a little afraid of a time when I'd have to do more than like a half an hour or 45 minutes of email every morning. And that's when I do it. I do it every day. People are always like, wow, thanks for answering. Like, you wrote to me. It's like common courtesy. So
a lot of people don't do it. A lot of people don't respond. So
some people can't, you know, I mean, yeah. I do think that if you get to a certain size, then I'm actually just flirting with using an editor now. Only recently, I found a musician who, you know, would know the difference between this Les Paul and that Les Paul. He's also a bass player. So, but just now, like where I would actually collaborate with somebody else on building a video. He actually pulled most of the image assets for the Lennon video. Well, there's only so many pictures of Lennon with the, you know, with the 190. No, it's just like, he pulled the pictures that I would have used because I had already done a search of the assets. So then I can do that. But if I'm making a video like the one I'm working on now, like the most important moment in electric guitar history, I can't let someone else tell that story through the images. That's got to be something that I edit.
Right. Funny. I did a feature with Keith Urban on his guitar collection, which was awesome.
Talk about juniors.
Say that again.
Talk about juniors.
Yes. Yeah. And one of the things we were profiling was a 57 gold top that he has. And his publicist sent me a photo of a 52 or 53 gold top with P90s in it. And it didn't even occur to me. And at the last second, we're about to go to print and I'm looking at this photo and I go, that's not the 57. That's the 52 because it's got the P90. Like that's the furthest thing from a 57. And his publicist goes, well, these came straight from the tech. You better be right. Like, I don't think you're right. I go, I bet the whole thing I'm right. I promise you. Sure enough, we replaced the photos. It's like, you need someone who knows these things.
Absolutely.
Otherwise,
absolutely true. Yeah. Even the minutiae, you know, it's funny. I said in an early video that if I was going to go, I did a video 4 years ago now where I featured Ariel, but I also featured Zach Childs. And I said, you know, with everything I've done, all the guitar histories I've written, if I was really going to go vintage shopping, I would stop and pick up Zach Childs and take him with me. I wouldn't go. It's not something you can do on your own. It's in the Guitars That Suck to Own. Like, owning a vintage guitar is a whole other bag. It's just a whole other search process. And in I was getting all this good stuff from the watch collecting community. There's an expression, you don't buy the watch, you buy the dealer. I'm like, that's completely true of electric guitars. I sent the picture of that 59 Junior to, I'm blanking on Hoagie's last name. This is embarrassing. The guy who owns Scruff's Vintage with the guy from Texas. And he owns Comet Amps. Anyway, Hoagie is like a guitar renovation repairman to the stars. He does work for Eric Johnson. He does work for Robin Ford. And I sent him a picture of it. Basically, even in that state that guitar's in, that's still a $5,000 guitar.
Right.
So you're talking about like, what could you get into? I mean, I would have to sell my Collings i30 and the guitar's not even for sale.
Right. You know? And Zach's story with his Esquire.
Oh, that's such a great story. Yeah.
But like you're saying, he saw that and he knew that there was something underneath the guts where it's like, I don't know, if you and I went shopping together, we might see that and be like, that's a pile of junk. What are we doing here?
Yeah. Well, and I'm not sure we would know the difference between like an early 90s made in Japan Esquire neck and a real one, you know?
Yeah. Whereas right.
Zach's like, oh, the decal's in the wrong place. I'm like, okay, here we go.
Right. Yeah. So you're a big proponent of the Stomp, the HX Stomp. You own two of them. I use them on my board.
Oh, you do?
I get frustrated with, like, sometimes I'm pulling up an amp model or an amp modeler, and I'm trying to dial it in, and there's too many options. And you're Mr. 5 watt world over here, and it's like, when it comes to the distance your mic can be from the cloth of the cap, it's like, I don't care. Just give me a deluxe reverb that sounds good. Like, I'm overwhelmed by the options. Like, do you struggle with that too with the HX Stomp, or have you sort of figured out your settings and you make it work?
I sort of treat an HX Stomp, and I'm actually somebody on, it was actually this guy, Chris, the Gigs with Vintage guys, like, you should put out, and Lyle from Psionic Audio, you should put out an HX Stomp pack of just your bread and butter, because they both know. I kind of treat an HX Stomp the way some people treat the DAW, as if it's a big tape machine. Like, I have a rack of things that I use for recording in Logic. Those are the ones I use. It's as if I have a small studio in my house. It just happens to be in my computer. I treat the HX Stomp the same way. I have a basement patch. I have a Marshall patch. I have a Litigator patch that I actually built with John Cordy, who's really so much deeper into the HX Stomp than I am. So when it comes to mic placement and those kinds of things, I just turn to somebody like John. And I think that is something. It's another thing, like community building. You have to just turn to people and not spend time. I heard on public radio that we're going to learn 20,000 systems in our lifetime. And I'm like, I don't want to learn another system. I have Jeff McElane use this fractal stuff. He's like, you really should try an FM3. I'm like, I'm not going to learn another system.
Yeah.
I'm not going to learn, you know, to edit in another whole system. So, I find that I use just a set number of amps. And that's what I use. That's it. I treat it like I could afford this collection of amps, which I sort of could, you know, if I purged off some more guitars, I could have a really nice AC-15 or an AC-10 like Zach's, or, you know, I could have one of each. And there was a time when I did have one of each, and then I went, I've got the Stomp. And for what I do, that's instead of my amp collection. And I sold, was it 2 summers ago? I sold off 14 amps.
No way.
Kept three. Yeah. Yeah. And a bunch of those I had built, because I went through a period of time where I was building my own amps. So, yeah.
And were the three you have, the Catalyst behind you?
Oh, so I have Catalyst mostly for testing. And although I have to say, if you put a pair of Catalysts in my living room and you set one on the Vox setting and one on the clean Fender setting, I'm as happy as you can be. And then I just use my HX Stomp for time-based effects. And then I use two pedals that I'm developing with David Barber. One does a Blues Breaker side and a Overdrive Special side, and the new one's a Boost Overdrive. That's based on an OD1 Clark Gainster kind of thing. I've been talking to Jed Hughes about it. Anyway, I don't do my drive from the Stomp, but I use it for all the time based. I would use it for I use it for all the tremolos. I'm actually going to work with XTS. I've been talking to Zach about it. I'm going to build this stuff on the floor behind me. It's why I'm pointing over my shoulder. To build a board around a Stomp XL, like what I would think of as a studio board. For a long time, I've thought about doing a board, because you see that Line 6 stuff. It's ubiquitous in Nashville pedal boards, period.
And that's why I got one, because I felt peer pressure to get one, basically, because everyone around me has one. I was like, okay, I got to bite the bullet and just know what they're about. That's literally why I got one.
Yeah. They're everywhere. I mean, whether it's the old M9s that they do or don't have somebody work on, you know, it's on Bukovac's board, it's on Wells's board, it's on Ostrander, it's everybody's board. So, and actually watching the Tone, True Tone Lounge, I had sort of collected pictures of people's pedal boards over the years. I'm like, this is always here. So I had this idea to build, I tend to have like three pedals, an HX Stomp and two drive pedals. That's my pedal board. But I thought, if I was going to build a studio board, what would it be on it? And so I was actually took a meeting with David Barber this morning. And one of the things I want to experiment more by way of most music lease gear is I want to learn a lot more about EQ. So I bought a Boss EQ 200, which has 10 real sliders. You can reach up in the sliders, and it's got 4 memory slots. And I'm like, I'm going to learn how to turn my Les Paul Deluxe into a Gretsch. I'm going to learn how to fatten up the bridge pickup or twang up the bridge pickup in my Strandberg Salen. You know, I'm going to learn more about EQ. Years ago, Rick said to me, he's like, why did my compressor video get a ton of views and my EQ video didn't get any? And I said, because people think they understand EQ, but they know they don't understand compression. He's like, oh my God, that's it.
People
think they understand EQ and they don't. So anyway, that board is going to teach me how to do that. I got to reach out to Barry at XTS and talk to them about it.
I love that. They're dangerous over there. They
Well, how much they know. And it's
Oh
not going
my
to be a big
God.
board. It's going to be like 18 by 13, you know, kind of thing.
That's my board. They did my board in 2018, and the guts of it are still the same. And every now and then I swap different things out. And then when I put the stomp on it, I took out a couple, like I took out a little row of pedals that I had. I just took
Yeah,
those
just
out
enough space.
and put the stomp down. I was like, hopefully I'm getting more than I'm giving up. And that was basically it. But it's the same board that they built like 5 years, 6 years ago, basically. And it's the same thing I'm using. Yeah.
Well, and that's the way it should be. You should get to know your gear inside out. I mean, it's it always cracks me up when Bukovac's like, oh, this is my fourth board. You look at him, it's like all the same stuff. Like these are you have four versions of the same stuff in different sizes depending on the airplane that you're going on. I don't know what that is, you know. So anyway.
That's how I feel. Like I've been using the same Timmy has been on my board since the 10th grade when I got it. I know exactly how to use it. I've got an Archer on my board and I've got the Atomic Overdrive from XDS, which is kind of like this very high gain pedal. It's the only gain stages I need, and I have a clean boost too. And I'm like, I'd rather just know exactly how to set these pedals than test anything else. It's like I have a bunch of other stuff, but it never comes out on the road with me because it's like I just want to know exactly how to use what I have in a pinch. If I need to dial something in or whatever, I just know exactly what to do with what I have, and that's all I need,
Well, and
basically.
the Stomp XL gives me a little more flexibility for loops. And I'm going to put that EQ in a loop, and then I'll put it before or after, depending on what I'm experimenting with, whether you're going to EQ everything right at the end before you send it out for recording, or if you EQ the signal going into the overdrive, which is a completely different thing.
Right.
So
Totally.
very interesting.
We're running out of time here, but you always ask your guests the 5-watt 15 questions. So I've got some here just to run through super quick. So okay, so if you're up for it, Keith,
Of course.
okay, here we go. Here
How
we
could I
go. Okay.
inflict these on other people and not succumb?
That's kind of what I
That
think. Okay.
you got
Best
me.
tip for someone who wants to start a YouTube channel.
Sit down and decide what the purpose is.
Okay, I like it. Best tip for someone who's already running a YouTube channel.
Spend more time on your titles and thumbnails. 50%
Titles.
of the time, I saw somebody recently, they're like, 40% of your time should be creating video ideas, 40% of your time should be on. And 20% of your time should be making videos and putting them out.
Okay,
And if
that.
you think about starting conversations, that makes sense.
I love it. Okay.
All right.
Best overdrive pedal to try right now. So maybe not a classic, but maybe something that has really caught your eye recently, or that you
Well,
think people should pay more attention to.
this is impossible for me to answer objectively because I designed an overdrive pedal with David Barber, the
That's the one.
Barber Bus, 5-watt World Bus. I have one behind me, but I should have had one ready to hold up, which
Are they for
does,
sale? I was trying to see where if.
they are for sale. They're up on Reverb. Actually, we even have them in two colors now. They're white and black. And we're working on another version of that that's going to come. And then we're working on a boost overdrive that specifically will be to paired with that pedal because it's one thing if you got two companies. But that's my favorite overdrive. It's the two sounds I like. I did that Beano album video years ago with Jeff and David. David did a ton of the research, and it does a great Bluesbreaker JTM 45 sound. Matter of fact, I think Jeff's going to put it on his board to go to Europe. And then the other side is an overdrive special. And to be honest, I probably use it. And then I would have guessed that I'd be like chasing the Robin thing. But yeah, I play it probably on the JTM 45 side just as much. So,
Very cool. Okay, I like it. Okay. Best memory of hosting your own YouTube channel. Is it someone sending you a 59 Junior?
Nacho Caster was more of a surprise because I just couldn't believe then, and the fact that the Nacho Caster came when I got that UPS slip saying that it was 18 pounds, I'm like, this guy sent me a guitar. So, and
That was
I
the
immediately teased him that I'm like, oh, you know what? I dusted it without thinking. I've completely devalued the guitar. You're just gonna have to leave it with me now. He's like, keep it as long as you need it. So.
Unbelievable. Okay. What's one guitar or amp that you should sell? You always you
Yeah,
you
this is my
you,
question.
you I know, I know. So I'm throwing it back on you.
I sold $2,000 worth of pedals in the last 24 hours.
No way.
I just did this. I just did a big purge of my pedal drawer. And one that's not in the pile that I should sell. They all went in the pile yesterday. Well, my favorite pedal that I sold out of that pile, because I will use David's instead now, is a very unusual J Rocket. I used a lot of J Rocket pedals, and they had a fuzz called the Hooligan fuzz that has a bias control on it. They called it the gunk control. It's bias. And if you go see, there's an amazing video that a Spanish YouTuber named Alberto Barrero did, and it's amazing. He gets so many good sounds. And I actually think that between a fuzz, mixing a fuzz at lower settings with an overdrive, those two pedals give you so many things, but people just dime their fuzzes. That's not it. So that one was hard to let go because they haven't built that for years now.
So why'd you let go of it? Why not keep it?
I actually am playing the little bit that I play fuzz. I play David's, and really, you know, you can find them. It's not like, a gold horsey or something.
Okay. So fair enough.
That would be the one. Yep.
Greatest guitar moment in history. You alluded to a video about this. Is it Dylan M.
Monterey?
You got to wait for the video. Okay, fine.
Well, so wait, this is your show. What would be your choice?
Is it for me?
Yes,
personally,
it's you personally. Yeah,
or
you
is
personally.
It, so for,
you can answer both ways. For you personally, and then the one that you think made the biggest difference overall.
For me personally, because the one where I just thought, oh my God, I remember seeing it so visually, was Pete Townsend at Woodstock playing the Red SG Special.
Yep.
And that would have to be it. In history, though, I mean, that one's really good. I mean, the Dylan at Monterey, but that's such a boring answer.
Dylan at Newport, you mean?
I'm sorry, at Newport, yep. Yes. But that's that's such a boring answer.
Well, the structure of that video is I go through things that I reached out to all these friends of mine, YouTubers and musicians that I know, and asked them what they thought it was. And this, I compiled all of those. And then there's just little segments about why that was important that Buddy Holly was on the Ed Sullivan Show in 1956, you know, playing a guitar that had only been out 2 years, plugged in. It's not like he's just standing there strumming. There's a chord running back.
Yeah. Right. So, but there's so many. I'm trying to think what else is,
When I do the video, you're going to go, oh, of course.
Oh, of course. Yes.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
Okay. I like it. What's the most crazy guitar myth that you think is ridiculous? Do you think there could be a real Modern out there from a 58? Is it possible that there was one
really
built?
I totally think one could exist. I mean, when I did the V video, I did that video because a guy had reached out to me because he owns the first real V prototype, which was not the one that the whole world thought existed. There was one before that, and it had a longer headstock, and they sent it to the case company, and the case company goes, if you did this headstock 2 inches shorter, it could go in the standard case. And the guys at Gibson went, oh yeah, I'm okay with that.
Yeah.
And so this guy owned that, and he bought that instead of an Explorer. Like, you would think it was the stupidest vintage guitar choice he ever made, except now he owns the one. So anyway.
Yeah. Unbelievable. Okay. One piece of gear that every YouTuber should have.
You know, a year ago, this never would have been on my list. I bought a gimbal for my cell phone, and it's an incredible piece of gear. And it's not, I think that the age of the, you know, selfie stick vlogging is over, thank God, but you can use it for so many things. And I think that B-roll video, you know, video storytelling is greatly underused, especially in the music space. It's funny, you watch these watch channels and there's all this, I was joked that it's watch porn. It's like these macro shots of the watch and it's zooming in and it's turning. And it's like, why isn't that splashed all over the guitar world? We're guitar nerds. We're going to want to see the pickups, the mini humbuckers on that guitar.
Yeah. Right.
You know,
right.
From 2007. So I think that that's actually something, and you could do that with a gimbal and a cell phone. So.
Okay. I like it. Okay. Yeah. Best part about living in upstate New York.
Not the weather.
No, but I like the seasons. Are
like
the seasons a good thing? I mean,
but you don't live here.
Well, I grew up in that part of the, I grew up around there.
You did, but you don't live here now. Okay, so my family is here. That's the easy answer is I grew up in a big family. My mom's 87; she's still alive, and I live about an hour from them. I don't mean to make it sound like I need to be an hour from them. I'm close enough that I can just go home, you know, and have my mom tell me stories, which it's an amazing thing. I think Rick and I had this, and Rick's parents were much older because he was the second youngest. I was second oldest. And, it's amazing that you continue to learn things from your parents. Even I'm 64 years old. I learned stuff from my mother, every conversation I have with her, because it's to the point where she's 87. There's like no story she can tell me about my childhood that's going to scandalize me now. It's just hysterical, you know? So anyway.
Right. I love that.
Upstate
okay,
New York.
Best live guitar performance you've ever seen. Or
Oh, I already
one of
answered
them.
this in a
Yeah.
bit. No, I already answered this in a video. The best live guitar performance I ever saw was on a bass. I saw Jaco Pastorius with Weather Report on July 1st, 1981 at the Eastman Theater. And he had an Echoplex and he set up a rhythm track by just slapping his bass to get a rhythm going. And then he proceeded to play Purple Haze. Just like note for note on a fretless jazz bass. And we
Can't
were,
top
and it,
Jocko.
it, it just, it just rattled everything in the building. It was so loud on a pair of, acoustic stacks. I still get, I got chills telling you about that right now. So yeah, just an amazing performance.
Unbelievable. Keith, I can't thank you enough for taking the time. We've ran through the hour. What have we left out? Has anything been unsaid? Have we not plugged anything that we should plug? The guitar pedals people need to check out on Reverb.
You need to buy a bus. Yeah, I've got this course coming and I'm not sure where I'm going to offer it yet. But that's coming about how to do YouTube for musicians. I do think it's a must have in the toolkit these days. And I think that idea about it starting the conversation, every musician I know is about community. I mean, ultimately they want to reach their fans. They want to reach their fan base. And I was talking to Jed Hughes about doing some stuff with him and his channel is about 9,000. And I'm like, okay, we're going to make you famous. And then that'll be good for me and it'll be good for you. That's what we're going to do. I'm going to help you with this channel. And I just don't think it's that hard. If you have all the stories that somebody like he has, it's just this incredible life as a musician still. And he was touring in Europe when he was like 13 years old as a fast tele picker.
Yeah,
So yeah.
right.
So I think that that's the thing that probably I'll do most help with in the next few years.
I love it. And why not check
Cool.
out True Fire if you're listening to this?
Oh,
He
absolutely. Yeah.
sponsors Keith's channel.
There you go. Actually, that's absolutely true. I have been working with True Fire, boy, now it must be 4 or 5 years, but it was me that reached out to them because I was already using them. And actually, so many people that I've used to play on videos, I met through True Fire, through the guys at True Fire. They're just really great. Yeah.
I'm always on True Fire. I'm always looking
Absolutely.
for a new course. Sometimes I download a course though, and I think to myself, okay, I'm not going to move on to another course until I master everything in this course, even if it takes me a year. And then I never get that done. I always get ADD with
No,
my True
I
Fire
don't think that's the way
courses.
to do it. I think you dip a toe in.
Yeah.
I see it as an inspiration well. If I go in and I find, one, I watch videos of Jeff McElhaney that he did like 15 years ago, or as he likes to say, when his beard wasn't white or something. And then he'll call me on the phone. I'm like, hey, stop interrupting. I was just listening to you. Or,
Yeah,
I do the
right.
same thing. I'm watching one of Rick's videos and then he calls on the phone. I was like, oh, I was just listening to you tell me a story. So it's pretty funny. Yeah. The YouTube is a funny world that way. So you're listening to all your friends. And like I said, building a community that's been probably the most special thing about doing YouTube, is meeting people and doing this stuff. So.
I love it. Keith,
All right.
thanks so much for taking the time on this Friday afternoon. Hope to see you in
Oh,
person. As well, if you're ever in Nashville, please let me know if
yeah,
you're back here ever
I
again.
actually, I'm due for a trip. I am due for a trip down
You're
there.
due for a trip. We'll go have lunch with Zach Childs
There you
and pop
go.
into some guitar stores
And
or
he'll
who
take us to
knows.
school. That's right. Very good.
He'll
Good idea,
take us to
Zach.
school, exactly.
Absolutely.
Keith, thank you
Thank you so
so
much.
much. I really appreciate it. Talk to you
Okay.
next time. Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye.